is an interview for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project at Museum LA. The date is Friday, March 13th, 2009. And we're at the home of Roy and
Mary.
Mary Tassinari.
Yep.
And this is Andrea Lumgia. Roy and Mary, could I just start by asking you to give me your names and your dates of birth?
Well, I'm Roy Tassinari. I will be 78 in April 24th, born in 1931.
And I'm Mary Tassinari, Mary Newton Tassinari, and I was born April 17th, 1931.
And where did you grow up?
Here in Auburn.
In Auburn.
Yes.
And what were your parents' occupations?
My mother stayed at home. My father worked in the shoe industry. He was a wood heel maker. He was superintendent of the Minot Wood Heel Company for several years. And then from there went to work at the lounge shoe building for the Lounge Wood Heel.
And what was the wood heel?
The wood heels, your high heels, shoes for women, were made out of hardwood, usually maple. Your wedgies were made out of softwood. And during that time that he was in there, they started making what they called their glass heels, which were a plastic. I'm pretty sure they called it Lucite at the time. But it was one of the first of the plastics.
And so what years was that?
That
you...
time? Let me see. I was, it had to be in the late 30s, early 40s.
And was that right in Auburn?
Right,
said?
That was right in Auburn. He first of all worked in the Minot Wood Heel. That was in one of the buildings along what's now the Union Street bypass. There were a couple of big buildings there. Then when he went to work for the Lounge Wood Heel, it was in the Lounge Shoe building. Now Roy left a picture of the building back in the, well, it was at that time was called the London Suite building. And that was, shoes were built in that whole big building. They were in the bottom part of it with making the shoe counters. And my father was in the back part of the building making the wood heels.
And how many children were there in your family?
Two, my brother and I.
And well, can you talk about what Auburn was like when this, I mean, you grew up when the shoe industry was thriving.
It was thriving. And it came in I would say right after or during the Depression. I was, when my dad was in there, and I, from what I can remember, say like the late 30s, and then into the 40s, it was a going, really going industry. I mean, there was an awful lot of shoes being built in the Lewiston Auburn area. And
it was the shoe city of Maine.
And there was, and because of that, I mean, you've got a lot of other businesses that come down to it. I mean, like the wood heel part of the business, that was completely separate, actually, from the shoe itself. If they were making wood heels, they weren't only making them just for that company. They were making them for companies all over the country, and being shipped out. So there were a tremendous amount of wood heels being made. And then later, of course, the plastic ones. And with the wood heels, those all had to be covered with leather, the same leather that the shoe was made out of, so that they were the same color. That was quite an operation in itself. But when the glass heels came about, then those got kind of fancy. And they even etched them out and did all kinds of designs on them and whatever. It was fun to watch, but then of course then it also, I mean, that developed during the World War, the Second World War, so you had that going on here in the Twin Cities, and that was my father was involved in being an auxiliary fireman at the time. His father was an auxiliary, he was a
air raid warden.
I mean, and we did it. We had air raid
blackouts
and things.
Don't remember that.
No.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
I mean, it was kind of eerie, I'll tell you. There were times.
You had to go around on your houses. We lived not too far from here growing up. I lived on Cushman Place right up here off of Western Avenue. And at nighttime, my father would go out during the war, and you had to be blacked out. I mean, you couldn't have any lights going out of your windows or anything else. The street lights were off and everything, and it was made so that if any planes did come over, that they wouldn't be able to see any part of the cities and stuff like that. You couldn't go out with your vehicles with the full headlights. They had to have little slits in them, almost like your military vehicles do today. But anyway, this is all back in that era when, you know, the shoe industry was thriving too. But it was, and, well, I don't know if we want to get into the counterpart of it right now, but this is what my father did. He came up from Lowell, Mass. In 1934, I think. I was 2 years old. And, 34. Yeah, 34, somewhere around there. And then we located in the Lounge Shoe Building, downstairs, the bottom floor, in the back part, actually. And then it moved to the front part. We, during the war, it was amazing that we made these shoe counters that goes in the back part of the shoe, goes off the last. And we at one point, we were doing over 1 million pair a week. And we were doing it with women, because all the men had gone to war. But then, of course, they came back after the war, and then most of them stayed. But then we kept some of our women. They were some of the best molders, we'll put it that way, than the men were. It was ironic, but and that's happening in today's world, too.
So you were born in Massachusetts.
I was born in Haverhill, Mass. And then my folks moved to Lowell. My father was running that shoe counter factory down there in Lowell, Mass. And they moved it up to Maine, because Maine was where the shoe industry was booming. Mm. I just talked to the owner last night, Dean Freeze. He came into it a little bit later, but Harry Brown was the owner of Brown Counter Company in Haverhill, Mass. And then, of course, this was an offspring from that counter company, and then it moved to Maine and became New England Counter. Brown Counter was still down there in Haverhill, but then New England Counter came up here to Maine, and it thrived for many, many years. And we make the back part of the shoe, which a lot of people don't even realize it's there. It's the part that holds your heel up onto your foot. And the shoe lasts that many probably have seen at some point in time, they have to be fitted to these lasts for the different types of heels, and there's all kinds of different kinds of patterns and styles that we had. We had over 4,000 styles that we had to keep making counters for, especially the high heel end of it. I have one particular die right here that was the first counter that was made for New England Counter up here in Maine, and this was presented to my father at back years ago, had an inscription on it. And that's a men's counter, by the way. That part there is one that would go for a larger men's counter, which I don't have right here.
Right.
And that, of course, is the way it's cut. But
yeah, these here are put on sheets of fiberboard, which is about almost 3 feet wide by 5 feet long, and they're only about maybe less than a quarter of an inch thick, and they come in pallets as the sheets are. And then these here dies are put on the sheets under a cutting machine, which comes down with a big beam dinker, how they call it, and it comes down and cuts those counters out. And a guy that's on the machines, really, it was a very, very dangerous job. There you are, you're holding this thing, you're bounding this die up and down that sheet like that, and that beam is coming down and cutting it off. And we have had a few guys cut their fingers off and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's usually on the top, more so
than under the bottom of the die. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you would think it would be under.
I would go there and pick up the finger and reattach it. The doctor would reattach it in some cases if it wasn't too badly smashed and stuff like that. But this happened throughout the industry, not just in the counter, in the shoe industry, when they're making the shoes and stuff there, when they're fastening them together. There was no safety issues at that point. I mean, it would just make it, and that's what it was. And these are other various dies that we had that made little inserts and cookies and stuff now like that. And I also had a small counter factory I moved up from Haverhill called Task Counter Company. And what we did, we mainly made the inserts for the arch supports for the shoes. And I did this out of a little operation right here. And we did that for a few years. And then it got to be a point where it was pretty hard doing that. And then I became superintendent of New England Counter Company. And because my father retired at that point.
Yeah. So you sort of followed in your father's footsteps.
Yeah. So and then, of course, later on in years, it steadily decreased as the machines and the whole situation started going overseas. And then, of course, sales dropped off dramatically. And then eventually New England Counter was bought out by Goulden Scammon, which was our competitor. And it was a debate whether we were going to buy them out or they were going to buy us out. And it kind of went back and forth for a while. And then they bought us out. And I went with them for 5 years as I was a purchasing agent and quality control. So, and then after that, I kind of was gone, and then I went into retirement myself. So.
Well, so tell me, you grew up in Auburn?
Mary and I both graduated from Middle High School in 1949. In fact, we're having our 60th year reunion this year. And we were on the committee.
And how many brothers and sisters did
you? I had one sister. She had one brother. Yeah. And my sister was a teacher in Massachusetts. Yeah. So, and she still lives down there, actually.
Talk to me about the Auburn community as a community and what it was like when you were growing up.
If you know Auburn and you know where Walmart is and that whole area, you may not remember when that was just a plain white home farm. And that's when we saw it back in our young years, teenage years and stuff like that. And it really has boomeranged. The whole Center Street was not Center Street like you know today. It was just a plain two-way road, and that's all it was.
In fact, you lived?
I lived on Center Street the first year, right on the top part of Kmart lot, right there. Because that house got moved way back down. That was a terrible year. It was cold. Wind would go right through the house and everything. And then we moved to Cushion Place here in Auburn.
But you were out of town when you were out there on Center Street.
Yeah, you were outside.
Was Court Street like the downtown?
Yes. This was up here. This is all pretty old, up in here.
Yeah. This house was built in 1958, we figure, approximately. 1858, excuse me.
But as you went up there, and on the left, up there where there's all those nice new houses in that area, that was another farm.
That was Merrill Haven
that
Farm.
That was Merrill Haven Farm. That whole area was all farm. Was right over on the next street over here is Merrill Hill School, and that was a little school. All of our kids went to school there, but that's now an alternative school. Well, first of all, they closed it up and used it as a storage area for a while, and then they made it into an alternative school for the middle school. Weston Avenue that was all there when we were in school. So in the 40s, that was all there. That probably was built up. Either probably just before Second World War, I'd say.
Somewhere.
Must have been an era in there. Or maybe even just as the war was starting, that general area.
And you've got to remember, too, that this was the Shoe City in Maine, Auburn was. And right across the street from the Lounge Shoe building was the Smith Shoe Company, and then there was another one, that which burned, and right there where Hannaford is right now today was two other shoe factories right there in that whole lot area right there. And it was amazing because, you went out Hotel Road and there was the Air Tread Shoe out there, and there was Bon Am, which became later on years.
And where Denny's is, there was a whole
line. There was the Cushman Hollis building.
A big building, just like the Lounge Shoe building.
Yeah.
And then going down Union Street.
Well, with Clark Shoe.
There was another one going down there.
Yeah. Right there where where you buy computer supplies and stuff right there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Staples?
No, not Staples. The competitor.
What's the other one?
Office Max.
That was a big shoe factory right there.
Oh,
that
okay.
was Clark Shoe.
All right.
And that burned later, at the very end. That burned then because they took
it down.
Well, they used it as a storage area
for a long, long time, and then it burned.
And that's where Mary's father worked at the very end.
At the very end, he was working down in there.
But it was a big era for the shoe industry, and then of course, like I said, it declined and started going overseas, and then little by little they went out or dissolved or whatever.
Right.
And then the buildings got tore down one by one. It's amazing that the Lounge Shoe Building, which, like she said, was the London Suite Building way back, is still there today. But they've kept it and maintained it, and because there's the little warehouse. Store down the bottom floor, stuff like that, and they still, the banks, I guess, have the top floor for storage, for records and stuff like that, and but there's no more manufacturing going on, and I don't know really if, I don't think there's anything in Lewis and Auburn area that really is doing much for manufacturing, maybe over in the Continental Mill in Lewis, which we moved to back in the late 70s, I guess it was, for a few years, and I think there might be, there was two or three shoe factories in that mill at that point. And I think I might be able to have more information on this stuff as we dig into it a little more. This all came up all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think. You said you started working in the shoe industry in the 50s?
Yeah.
So you were in your 20s?
Yeah.
Yes.
And when you were teenagers during World War II?
Yeah.
What sorts of things were you able to do as teenagers for social?
Well, don't forget the Edward Little was originally down there on Academy Street. That's where we went.
Okay.
Which
yep.
is now being used with multi things and the theater thing, whatever it is.
Right.
And because social things, while I was in high school, because my father was running the the counter factory, and then at a side job we had a little lobster business. And so every week I had to leave from high school and go down to the coast and pick up 1,000 pounds of lobsters or whatever and bring them back to Auburn Lewis and sell them to places like the Plaza Grill, the Joy Inn restaurant, which is all gone, Nanking restaurant, that was all gone, and I had all these other places that I had to peddle these things out, and mostly lobsters, sometimes clams and stuff like that. Because later on in years, we have a place down at Harpswell that I grew up as a kid, and because her folks did too down at Lookout. And we run it as a bed and breakfast right now at Lookout Point in Harpswell called Bellevue by the Sea. And it's BellevueMaine.com if you want to go on the internet and look it up. Yeah. And you'll see me with a pot of lobsters there and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we still run that. We got already reservations for this summer. We've been doing that for 22 years.
Oh, great.
So that's part of the thing after retirement.
Right.
We kind of do that only in the summer. It's closed up right now.
Yeah.
It's all cold. But anyway. And then that's where I met her down there. I was raking sea moss down there in the summer. And if you don't know what sea moss is, it's a cauliflower type of a seaweed which grows below the seaweed line at very low tides, and you have to rake it with rakes like that, and then you brought it up by the boatloads, and you sold it I think at that time I was only getting a half a cent a pound or something, but my boys, as they grew up there, they were getting about a cent a pound of something of water and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they dry it up and use it as a gelatin, as a
thickener,
but like toothpaste.
Things that you see carrageenan in.
Okay.
Is carrageenan is what they get from sea moss. It's also gotten from kelp, and I think they get more of it from kelp and stuff now than they used to.
Yeah. So then as I kept coming up through there, and I come up through there, because she's trying to show me where her vaccination was,
come on.
And that's when I met her.
We were in the same class in school, but we really didn't know each other in school.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we had a class of around 240, and we really didn't. I mean, I knew who he was, but that was,
yeah.
You know, that was it.
Yeah.
But when I was in school, I was in the band, so I was pretty busy. We had a good band, and but getting back to the war and everything, I was in the band. Because we didn't have the ninth grade in high school. I mean, our ninth grade was in with the 7th and 8th grade. So, but in, that had to be 1945, I was in the band, and we took a trip to Canada, to Montreal, because this was the first,
competition?
Well, it was a competition, but it was called something else. I can't think what it was called. But it was the first one since the World War, since the war. Because during the war, they didn't have it. They still had band in school, but I mean, they didn't have the competition and stuff. So we went to Montreal by bus. But that was, it would have been in 1945, and so, you know, there were a lot of things that didn't get done during the war.
Right.
But,
and we all didn't look quite like this photo right here, back when we were teenagers, but
not quite.
That was a mini one over at Marco's in Lewiston that did that. And then this one here, just one of they took a picture of. Anyway, just kind of.
Yeah.
But another thing that had happened during that time was the Edward Little, the top floor of Edward Little burned. They had a big fire down there. And so for quite a long time, we were at Webster, which I think we were in 7th or 8th grade at that time or something. And they because of the fire that they had at Edward Little, they had to close the school down. And so they came up and used Webster School, the high school did. They went to school mornings, and we went to school afternoons.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of very different.
Going back to the counter business there, I have a earnings record here for 1958, which I had a gross pay of $85 a week. That gave me a yearly earning of $2,295 a year. That was in the year of 1958. And goes to show you how different things have happened right now. You can't hardly get that for an hour. So I just happened to find these downstairs.
You had something you found a long time ago, though, that was way, way back when your father first came up here.
And it was 40 some odd dollars a week, I guess.
Well, I think it was less than that even.
And now you had those records because this was your...
When we were sold out to Gould and Scammon, I just grabbed a lot of stuff, and I got a whole bunch of more stuff records, payroll records and stuff like that, which is quite interesting because considering the time, and like $85 a week, and the insurance, like health insurance, is only $1.25.
Yeah.
So income tax was $6.10, and FOAB, that's $1.91. So I mean, it just goes to show you that I only brought home $75 a week. And at that point, we had two or three kids already at that point, I think.
56, 57, we had two.
Two,
Karen didn't come till 59.
Yeah. Wow. We had four boys and two girls.
Yeah. So do they all still live?
Yes.
They're all in Maine.
Yeah. They're all in Maine.
One of my sons runs the electrical systems of Maine, out there on Minot Avenue, right across from Morris and Sylvester. He's got quite an operation. He's got 23 vehicles on the road, I guess, all the time.
Wow.
So
our oldest son lives down in Arundel. He works out of New Hampshire. They make machines for the
newspaper industry, which is now getting hurt very badly. I mean, your newspapers, if you know what's going on with that industry right now, that's another whole situation that's going on
right now.
You get it on your BlackBerry and stuff like that, the news and stuff like that, and that type of thing. The internet, I mean, I got a computer and I got a fax machine and everything else right here that I have to, because I was president of the Maine Snowmobile Association back years ago, and I'm still chairman of Maine Tourism, and then I'm involved with the bed and breakfast and stuff like that. All this stuff, all this information is coming through the internet and stuff like that. And it's not like back in those days, they didn't even know that about even keeping records. I mean, I don't. It's one of these would even typed out back in those days. considering. But
Did any of your children work in the shoe industry?
Yes. When they were in high school, they came there and they worked in the factory. My daughter was a pack counters for a while. She decided that is not what she wants to do for her life. That's my oldest daughter, and she became a music teacher, and she works now in Yarmouth school system, and she's a music teacher down there. My youngest daughter, of course, never did work in the shoe factory because she was too young. She came.
No, it was gone by then.
Yeah, but my sons did, and they did deliveries and that type of thing, and they decided that was what they were going to be doing. Yeah. So two of them electricians. I got one that's a carpenter, and then of course,
Patty works right now as the secretary at Fairview School. But she worked in the bank for quite a number of years, and right now she's kind of waiting to see if she gets into nursing school. She's decided she wants to be a nurse.
You'll know next week, I guess. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah.
Of course, and don't forget, before we were married, I was in the Air Force for 4 years. And I was 2 years in New York, and then I was 2 years in Germany. And because we've been having Air Force reunions. Yeah. In fact, we got one coming up in Chicopee, Mass. This coming fall. And we've been to Colorado, to Canada. We've been to the International Snowmobile Congress.
And we went back to Germany.
And we went back to Germany one time to the same base. And yeah. I showed her where my bed was back in 1953. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, we've kind of bounced around. We haven't gone, not to China. But we've gone to
other places.
We've been to Alaska and that type of thing. So,
this is an old picture. What does this say? This picture taken in 1923. It was in the paper in 1985. Somebody gave me the picture, and I think my mother is in this picture. She did work before I was born, but I think. I don't know where she worked, but yeah. I think that was her.
Wow.
You know, I can't be positive, but I think it looks like pictures of her.
So does it say which place it is? It's a stitching room.
Several months ago, we ran a picture submitted by Mrs. Georgette DeMore featuring the stitching room of the Alt Williamson Shoe Company. Uh-huh. And I think that's
right.
The one my mother worked for, yes.
Yeah, because when we lived on Cushman Pete, place here, in up on top of Garth Hill here, the Alts was our landlords at that point. And I remember bringing down the rent, $5 a week, I guess, for the rent and stuff like that. And he was in that was the Alt Shoe, that's right. Mm. And I don't, because that was way before my time as far as knowing part of our customers and stuff.
Right.
Our customers for the counter industry was all over the country, too. I mean, that one just situated here in Maine. I mean, we were shipping counters, Red Wing Shoe, which is still in operation today, and those were a lot of boot suppliers and stuff like that. And, of course, they do make military shoes now, too. And that was another thing. We had military contracts that required a lot of specialty-made back part counters made of water-resistant material and stuff like that. So
now, I mean, there were so many people in the community that worked in the shoe industry.
Either shoe or in the mills.
Right. And I mean, when the shoe shop started closing, did you have a lot of friends that moved? Or what happened dynamically to the workforce? Do you have a sense of that?
A lot of them stayed, and I think at that time when it started to downsize, the shoe industry people were getting older too. I think your people at that time were in there probably their late 50s, early 60s, or almost getting at that point right there. So they either hung on or.
And of course, Social Security had come into being. So I think a lot of them retired.
Yeah.
A lot of them did. And of course, the younger people weren't going into it because it was obvious it was a dying industry.
Well,
so.
So, I mean, it was not one of those things that.
So a lot of it kind of worked out all right, but it was the one stuck in the middle. I mean, like his father's generation, it was fine. They were all retirement age. But it was the next generation down. It was our generation, really, that had the problems. I mean, they just had to go elsewhere and find something else to do, which was not easy. I mean, when you're told when you're 55 or 56 years old, whatever, that you're not needed anymore, that's where do you go find a job?
I mean,
at a time when it's like right now, when there was a lot of unemployment. I mean, there was just no place to go.
And that was during Depression years, too. I mean,
was the depressed area. I mean, recession or whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, that was one of the reasons that we started doing the bed and breakfast. I was still working
at that time.
Because I worked in the hospital. But, and there were, at that point, in the late 80s, this would have been in the late 80s.
Because you were a medical technologist.
There were five of us women working in the lab who were supporting our husbands. I mean, we used to joke about that. But there was a lot of unemployment at that time. And, you know, there wasn't much to find. Certainly there wasn't anything that you were, there was nothing you could do that you were used to doing.
Right.
Whatever you went into, you had to go, had to do something else. And so.
Now, what haven't I asked you that you think is important to add? Like the process? We haven't talked about this tool here. It looks, I'll just say on the tape, it looks to me like, in some ways, a pestle, but very, very heavy.
Yeah, and it's got it's bound by leather rings, actually. These are rings of leather.
Okay.
And they have to replace them every once in a while. This here would unscrew off of here, and this was used to bang on cutting dies to cut out either paper patterns or some very light material. You could not use something like that to use on dies to cut through the heavier counterboard because it would just not be heavy enough.
Right.
I got one question I want to ask. Did they cut just one layer a board at a time, or did they put more than one layer?
They cut five layers of fiberboard.
That's
that was five layers that they cut at a time. So they were all cut out in sheets, and then they were all stacked in boxes, and then it went through, the process went through a skiver machine, which skived out the counters and made them into a process of slicing off just the very, very, very edge.
Right.
So that they could be formed and made to go and be, this here is pretty much the pattern of this right here.
Right.
And it goes through a molding machine. The material is wet first, and then it's made to go through a molding machine, which becomes this process. This is what they call a stitch down counter, which goes on a shoe last, which is made with a sole, and the counter is stitched to the sole of the, on the last. And it's not stitched to the last itself. And then the rest of the process of the shoe is being made and fitted to the last, and then all comes one product. But this is going way back to the beginning and where it's cut off from a die, and then it goes through a skiver machine, and then they go through a waxer machine, which kind of half rolls it, and then it goes to the molder, who molds it into the final product, and then they go through the packing process and goes out to the various customers.
Okay, now once it's molded, what keeps it from coming out? Heat or anything else?
No. Once it's molded. Did have a process where we did have heated molds for some of the material that we had, but not the regular molding machines.
Okay.
They were done cold, and they were very damp and moist. And you had to keep a burlap bag at night, damp burlap bag over the material if you didn't have them finished, so they wouldn't dry out. Otherwise, you couldn't mold it dry.
It would crack.
And once it's molded, it goes into a basket, and then it dries, and then they throw it onto a packing bench, and then there's women packers that are packing these in bunches of five, and then they pack them together, and then they're shipped out to the different customers. So and it's quite a process, especially when you're talking about a million pair a week. I mean, that's a lot of counters and stuff like that. That's 2 million pieces, but that's a million pair we're talking.
I know people have talked about that they operations moved overseas, and that was part of the decline in the shoe industry. Were there any other factors that you saw contribute to that?
You know, a lot of the process went overseas like that, and a lot of the machinery and stuff went over there, but a lot of it got trashed and got junked. I know a lot of our molding machines never went anywhere. They were just trashed into scrap metal and stuff like that, which is too bad.
As far as the counters were concerned, that has kind of faded out. Most of your shoes, you don't find counters in them anymore.
And they went into plastic counters from there.
Yeah.
They went what they called back pot molding. Back pot molding was a process which was poured plastic into a mold, and then it just came out all done. It didn't have to go through the whole molding process.
Yeah.
So that's what the back pot molding was.
But most of your shoes, I mean your boots all still have counters in them. But, I mean, most of your shoes... don't really have much of a conversation. I mean, because there's so many sneakers. Because sneakers really came into being around that time, too. Because we, at that point, we had, what was the one that you went to work for a little while there? Etonic. But that was an altogether different thing. I mean, you didn't have these kind of parts that went into the shoe like that, so...
Now, Carlos, of course, going back a little ways from the beginning part, you had to have a patent maker, had to make paper patterns. From the paper patterns, then we send that to the dye shops, these particular dye shops. We had one, Main Dye, which was affiliated with our counter factory, and they would take and they make a tin template like that. And then from the template, then they would go and they'd make the dye, which is similar to that. This happens to be a children's 1.5-inch size counter that we're looking at here right now. And of course then it goes from that process to the cutting die, and the cutting die then goes and starts cutting the material out and stuff like that. But that's another process too, because you've got the die shops that have to be around here to make the dies.
Right.
So that we can use the dies to make the counters.
But the counters themselves, I mean, that was a real art in designing the counters. I mean, they had to fit perfectly. And now if you've got one type of a shoe here, and you've got to have this counter, you've got to have all the sizes. You've got to have you can't take one counter and put it in every shoe. Right. Every size has to have a die. So, and it's very important as to how that thing fits. I mean, there were certain people. His father was very good at it, and but he was not. He never got into doing that part of designing the dies. But that was quite a process in itself.
Yeah. Because my father was in there, then of course as I came up then, because I was assistant superintendent, then because when he retired I became superintendent. These here are leather cookies. Now, they're not the type that you eat. they are scribed also, they were cut off from a die. I think that is, that's the style that was pretty much cut out of, I guess.
And now what is the cookie?
Now that cookie there is what goes on the inner part of the shoe. To keep an arch support. It's an arch support, really.
Arch support, okay.
Some of my shoes have.
And that is what I did when I came up from Havel the first few years as a task counter company.
Most of those are kind of made out of foam now.
Yeah. So, and this is the leather that you'd probably cut that particular thing out of there. After it's skived, then that's what it looks like. But that's the material, the raw material right there, cowhide. So
did you have a supplier, a leather supplier?
I had to get that out of Brockton, Mass. I had to have them come up with bags of leather. They would have leather hides that they would cut up different materials for the shoe industry that goes into the regular shoes, and they'd have large pieces that were still left over, and then of course that I would have to buy the pieces that I could cut these out of, and they would be delivered up here by the truckload, actually, by the ton. And and then because then I had to cut them up. I had a cut machine downstairs here actually, and so I did that for years.
I used to skive them.
Yeah.
When I was home with the kids,
right?
Because I didn't work when the kids were small.
And she was up here counting to put them together.
Yeah. So a team effort.
Yes.
Well, it you needed to supplement your income, it was, you know. And it wasn't very great in those days because things didn't cost that much. Your loaf of bread didn't cost $1.50 like it does today, but it's only like 10 cents a loaf. So I guess everything is relative when you think about it, you know. And gasoline was only like 5 gallons for $1 or less, you know. And that's pretty much what we've done. I mean, you know, like I said, during the high school days, I went down and got lobsters and stuff like that. My father also brought... During the war, there was gas rationing. Gas rationing was a big thing. And he used to get extra coupons because to go to Harpswell because we'd haul soda and supplies down to the stores down there. And so every weekend, we'd go down there with a whole back of the trailer full of sodas and supplies.
Come back with lobsters.
And we'd get extra coupons for gas. And during the rationing years, you don't realize it, but butter was rationed and meat was rationed and everything.
Sugar.
And sugar and stuff like that.
So each family got only so much.
Yes.
Yep.
You had coupons, and you could only get so much.
Yeah. So
so much.
You don't have to remember that, huh?
No,